This episode of the Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show is brought to you by Pariah Pickups. That's right. Pariah Pickups have been powering my guitars since the Pound Cake Pickups came out. If you're a guitar player and you're looking to recreate that Van Halen sort of 90s DiMarzio kind of thing, and you can't really afford to get those crazy prices that the DiMarzio pickups go for online, well, the Pariah Pound Cakes do such an incredible job of recreating that tone. Use the promo code Jeremy at checkout for some instant savings. PariahPickups.com. That's PariahPickups.com. Use the promo code Jeremy at checkout for instant savings. Let's get right over to this week's episode. Mike Reno from Loverboy. You can watch the entire interview on my YouTube channel, YouTube.com/Jeremy White Show. Make sure you like and subscribe. You go watch it, but now you got it on demand right now. Enjoy.
An all-new episode of the Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
Tuesday at noon.
Available wherever you stream.
You are currently speaking to one of the greatest singers in Canadian history.
Oh, I know. And Mike Reno's here, too.
Well, hey now.
Look, let's get right into it. Live on Unzoomed, kicking off big tour alongside Styx and REO Speedwagon. Loverboy is going to be hitting the road, kicking off Grand Rapids on May 31st, all the way through St. Louis, Tinsley Park, Illinois, making stops in Clarkson, Cincinnati, Kansas City, Tampa, West Palm Beach, pretty much all the big cities across the U.S. and A. Welcome to the show, an absolutely iconic Canuck, Mr. Mike Reno from Loverboy, everybody.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing?
We're good.
Doing great. So great to talk to you. You know, the last time that I saw Loverboy was in Saint-Hyacinthe, Quebec a couple of years ago, and you were just phenomenal. I mean, you've always just been phenomenal. So
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I do work at it, and I am a little nervous about jumping in and doing 45 shows this summer with this touring carnival of greatest hits. It's going to be amazing.
It is absolutely going to be amazing. And we have two great Canadians on there. Don't forget, we've got Gowan on that bill too, right? I mean, Lawrence is going to be there. So
yeah. Lawrence Gowan, good guy, great friend. I can't wait to see him.
Yep.
Last time I saw Loverboy, actually, I was 16 years old, and I was working local crew on my native reservation. You guys came play here in Gahnawake. It was like a one-off show, and I got to be Paul Dean's assistant guitar tech for basically the day, so that was a lot of fun. And it was the one time I ever got to see Loverboy, so I'm absolutely going to try and catch one of these shows this year.
Yeah.
So where was that? What part of the world was that?
Quebec.
It was just outside of Montreal on a native reservation, just across the water in a town called Gahnawake. And you guys played a place called Maddie's Place, which isn't there anymore. Actually, the owner just passed away a couple of weeks ago. And it was a fantastic show that night. I mean, it was just really great. And the cool thing about Loverboy is that, like, you know, the live mix can make a really great band sound awful. And the live mix that night was so good. It sounded like the record. Like, it was just so, like, so that's always been in my mind. Like, man, Loverboy just sounds great live. So,
yeah, absolutely. Let's get on to this new release called Release. It is a single for now. Is there more coming down the pike? Does this lead to an album or a greatest hits with a couple of bonus tracks? What is the plan for new music with Release and what's coming next?
Well, we're doing singles right now. Okay. Actually, we can't even be in the same room together, really. You know, for a little while, it's been a little nutty, as you know.
Right.
So what we did is we had to record this one all through the internet. Like, Paul and I got together and wrote the song, sang the song. But we sent it off to Doug, our keyboardist. He did the keyboards. And we sent it off to Maddie, our drummer in North Carolina. He took all the drums on. We sent it to Winnipeg. I mean, this has been a round the horn type thing. But going in the studio is something I'm looking forward to. What I'd like to do is get these guys together back in Little Mountain Sound where we cut a lot of our great albums.
Yeah.
And I'd like to get all five of us in the room with a really good engineer and a producer and just kick some butt. I'm looking forward to it. But, you know, we got to wait till everything calms down a little bit.
Yeah. It's funny you talk about Little Mountain Studio, and I was just saying how great you guys sound live. I mean, it starts with the songs, and even going back to those records you did with Bruce Fairburn and Little Mountain Studios, I mean, those records just sound so good.
Yeah.
They still sound good. I was quite surprised. I heard one the other day when I was driving around, and I said, man, it still sounds good on the radio. So we really had a good bunch of guys right off the bat. I mean, we were pretty fortunate to have Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock, and not to mention Mike Fraser.
Yeah.
He was an engineer. Now he's recording and mixing AC/DC albums. I think he's done the last six AC/DC albums.
Something
you
like
know
that.
What I mean? second engineer on a Loverboy album to doing six AC/DC albums. I mean, and then, you know, Bob Rock, of course, is just fantastic. He's done everybody, you know, from Metallica to Bublé, you know, like, and everybody in between. Sadly, Bruce Fairburn passed away a few years back. He's terribly missed. He would have probably gone on to done even more great records for sure.
Yeah.
Talk to me quickly about that Canadian sound, because when we look back to the 80s, you know, we do think of Bryan Adams and we do think of Loverboy and Honeymoon Suite and all that. But what we sometimes forget is how important Vancouver and the sound was, bringing in AC/DC, bringing in Motley Crue, Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, Scorpions. Talk to me about that scene with Bruce and Bob and Little Mountain. And it was like a team, right? And Jim Vallance, can't forget Jim.
You know, I tell you what, it actually started with the group Prism. You remember?
Yeah, Jim Vallance was drummer for Prism.
He was the drummer and he wrote all the songs and co-produced it with Bruce Fairburn. Back then, I think he was using the name Rodney Higgs. So it was a little, a little bit of a, Anyways, and if you really listen to that album, that was done in Little Mountain too. That was probably the first album done there. Shortly after that album, we got Fairburn and Bob Rock and Mike Fraser together with our band. I mean, we were so lucky to have that. It was, and they were basically kind of starting their careers. It was really at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we all kind of rode up the totem pole together. Every time we see each other, we have a really good mutual, love for each other. And it's great to see guys, after all these years, because they've done so well and we've done very well. And it's just been a really great ride. I got to tell you, it was pretty special back then. I mean, I would be hanging in the studio and the guys in Motley Crue would be on the other side, or Aerosmith would be on the other side, or Trooper would be on one side, I'd be on the other side. I remember helping out with some of the vocals on Aerosmith albums and Bon Jovi albums, and they just said, "Can you just come in and go, whoa?"
Right.
I go, and then it turns out it's Living on a Prayer. You know, just go on. You never knew.
I don't think a lot of people give you guys the credit, because in reality, had you guys not made those records with Bruce and really created that innovative sound that kind of sculpted the tone of the 80s, I mean, you listen to the cowbell and then that first cannonball snare, I mean, that basically created the template for all the records that Bruce and Bob did going forward. I mean, you wouldn't have the Little Mountain loading bay drum sound had you guys not done that record, you know?
I was just gonna mention that loading bay. You know what I don't know if a lot of people know this, but what they ended up doing, there was a loading bay where you load all the equipment in the back, and it was just a big, maybe three-story high, really two-story wide, empty place where you back the truck in and load stuff up. Well, they put speakers out there and ran the sound of the drums through the speakers and then re-recorded the room. And that created that big sound. And it wasn't like an electronic sound. It was a natural sound. It was organic. And I think people started coming from all around. I remember Aerosmith came, Motley Crue came. Just insane. There's people all over the place, like from all over the country. And in Europe as well, they came to use that studio. And hopefully, I mean, by the time we did our second record, we couldn't even get a hold of Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock because they were busy.
They stopped taking your call. They're like, no, we don't talk. But talk to me about that, because their talent gave you a sound, but at the same time, you having great songs gave them a reputation. So it was a two-way street where if your record had stiffed, nobody would care to go work with Bruce and Jim and all those people. But at the same time, the sound on the record was so good. So talk to me about how they sort of helped you, but at the same time, you helped them by just being so good.
Well, it's probably true. Bruce Fairburn did a cool thing when he was producing. He was, in my opinion, he was in tune enough or smart enough to just let us play. So some bands don't do it that way. Pardon me. Some bands have to record and then just do it singly and then put everything on singly. Our band really recorded basically live. I remember Mike Fraser would set up the microphones on the instruments. We'd sound check for about 3 days, and then we would just start playing, and they just record everything. And a lot of times that was the end of it. That sounded great. Next song, let's go. And we recorded fast and we recorded together. And Fairburn could see that that was good for us. I mean, some bands don't do it that way, but we did it that way. He noticed it. He kept it going. And I think it's important that you figure out what your band's good at, no matter who you're producing. And he was very good at that. And of course, twisting the knobs, you can't get much better than Bob Rock.
Yeah. And I mean, the sounds of those records, like I said, I mean, there would be no Slippery When Wet or Pump, Love in an Elevator with those drum sounds and all that. I mean, those Loverboy records, they really did create the template, in my opinion. So
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing you said. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Talking about some incredible producers and songwriters, I mean, you know, Bruce and Bob and Mike, obviously fantastic, but you know, one of my favorite songs for you guys, Loving Every Minute of It, that was written by Mutt Lang. And I've always been curious, how come Mutt didn't work in the studio and produce that song with you guys?
Well, I think he was a little busy doing some unknown band called, let me think, Death Bird. No, and you know what happened is, at the time, Brian Adams was working with Mutt Lang and they were writing and doing stuff together. Do you remember that period? And during that, also that time, we were using Bruce Allen as our manager. So was Brian Adams.
Right. Still does.
And, when we actually told Bruce, we think we need one more song and we're kind of like running out of time in the studio. And he said, well, let me call Mutt Lang. And we kind of just went, you can call Mutt Lang. You know what I mean? It was just this crazy. And anyways, he called the studio and he says in his nice English, polite gentleman English accent, said, I've got a song for you. But the only way we could get it quickly was he played it into, he held the telephone up in his studio. We recorded a little micro cassette and then we listened to it intensely and we picked out the parts we're supposed to play and we went in the studio and we cut the thing. It was pretty magic, to be honest with you. It was crazy.
Yeah. So you recreated the demo that you heard over the phone in the studio, basically.
Yeah.
Exactly. We learned the song, you know, and it was just a tiny little cassette thing. It didn't sound very big, but you could imagine. And we learned all the parts and we went in the studio because back then there was no internet.
Right.
And that's what you had to do. You couldn't just send the song like you can send it now. So we just had to figure it out on our own. And so that was kind of exciting.
Wow. That's cool.
And of course, back then you had the satellite delay on the phones, which was even better. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Talk to me just real quick about the impact of video, because for me, I was in Quebec and much music comes out and I'm not really hearing a lot of Loverboy on the channels that my parents were listening to. And then much music comes out and it seems as though we've got a steady stream of Honeymoon Suite, Loverboy, Brian, I mean, CanCon just all day long. How impactful was that for you? Because as a fan, that's where I go, oh, I know that band now. And that's how I got to know you, through MTV, or through Much Music, I should say.
Well, MTV was a big starter. They started first.
Of course.
When our record company asked us to go to Albany, New York, to the Shrine Auditorium, and we were going to do some filming.
Right.
That's really all they said. So he said, we're probably going to do it for 3 days. And so we played about 5 or 6 songs. And out of those songs, they sent it to a producer, and they made them into videos with... We didn't even know what they were called back then.
Wow.
We sent 3 of these videos to MTV the first week they were open. So they immediately played us, you know, put us on a heavy rotation, which, you know, that's really hard to get. But back then, if you've got a 24-hour music cycle and you don't have enough
content,
you just play them all. It made us like completely, you know, you're faceless. Well, we definitely weren't faceless anymore. And then shortly thereafter, Much Music started. And it was the same thing for Much Music. I think Canada is very proud of the fact that we're Canadian, and we're very proud to be Canadian. So that's great. Much Music, fantastic.
Yeah,
it really was. You said that you were sort of nameless, faceless. Talk to me a little bit about that, because back in that time, there was a lot of stuff going on with pyro and makeup, and you got Kiss, and you've got all kinds of stuff. Loverboy never really did that. You sort of just came out and said, we got songs. Why didn't you go to gimmicks?
It's true, Ben. You know what? I'm glad you pointed that out. We kind of figured we'd just give them the songs and the energy. And we get the energy back from the crowd. That's kind of still what we do today.
Right.
We just go on stage and we bang right into it, you know, jump on stage and jump into The Kid Is Hot Tonight right out of the bat. And everybody just goes, holy shit, that's The Kid Is Hot Tonight. You know, right up, we're not dicking around. And there's no pyro. There's no fancy, dancy lighting system. It's just basically Loverboy playing their songs. And that's kind of what I'm proud of. I really am. Thanks.
Well, yeah. And I got to say, when I saw you at that time in Santa Ascent a couple of years ago, and I've seen you before, it's amazing how in 75 minutes you just go, that's a top 10 hit, that's a top 10 hit. Oh, look, they figured out with another top 10 hit. I'm looking just...
Yeah.
It's amazing. All right. How do you look back on your catalog? Are you one of those bands that say, we still haven't written our greatest album, or you just go, you know what? Fuck, we fucking nailed it.
I think we nailed it. You know, I really do. There's a point, you know, where you could throw new songs out till the day you die. But for some reason, the magic of the time, the magic of, and just the whole, what was going on at the time, those songs have become part of people's DNA. And it's for real. Yeah. I mean, they went to high school with them, or whatever school they went to, and they went to university. You know, they got married to some of these songs. Almost Paradise was a big song at weddings. You know, the Kid Is Hot Tonight, they play stuff like at hockey games. They play stuff at football games.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, they got them in sitcoms now. They got them in TV commercials. It's just everything is covered, and it's a testament, to, I think, to good songwriting. But I try to be humble about that. But it is a while back, and I don't think we'll ever have songs as popular as that again. I just think that's just the way it is.
That's just the way. Well, you look at working for the weekend. It's not just a song. It's part of the vernacular now, where people go, "Oh, it's Wednesday. I'm working for the weekend." You know, it's become a cultural thing. You changed our lexicon, quite frankly.
Basically.
That's right. Dylan, Friday nights, everywhere we go, Friday nights, you can hear it at 5 o'clock. They just hit.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was on the school bus going, I was in grade 8 back in like 2007. And then, like, you know, Terry and Ted and Kim in the morning on Show 97.7, I'd hear it at 7:40 right after Revisionist History. You'd hear that cowbell and all, it became a thing. And that was my exposure to it. And I mean, great songs, they just transcend generations.
Yep.
All hell breaks loose when you hear that cowbell kick.
Yeah. Speaking of that cowbell, where is that cowbell now?
Our drummer's got it in his drum bag, and we're going to be pulling it out in another 3 weeks.
Wow. Is it still the same cowbell? Because that should be like under glass, like with a light on top of it, like, you know, on display.
Right beside the red leather pants, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. With a picture of like Albert Bouchard from Blue Oyster Cult going, I got one of those.
The cowbell crew.
Hey, you know who was one of the first to do the cowbell thing was Mississippi Queen.
Yeah.
Right.
Mountain.
Yeah, Mountain. Leslie West. He was a good guy.
Yeah, yeah. I had a chance to interview him a couple of times. Unfortunately, he passed away, but he was so, so good. Talk to me quickly about this tour. So you've got REO Speedwagon. You've got Styx. They're flip-flopping sort of the headlining slot. How do you sort of go about it? Do you sort of think we got to upstage these guys and we're just going to go full tilt? Or you just go, listen, we're just going to go give them half an hour. Then we're going to go back to the, you know, catering and we're just going to relax. Like, are you like, you know, out for the attack and you want to win the night? Or are you just like, we'll just do half an hour and we'll go to catering. We'll be good.
Let me just tell you what happened last week. My manager calls me and he says, I just got a call from Live Nations. Mm. He says, this tour is selling out so fast. He says, I've dealt with these bands together many years in a row. Well, this is Live Nations. He says, this is the first time this tour is selling out well in advance. Because the only thing we could think of it is that we added Loverboy. And he says, you guys got a lot of fans out there and we want to take you on the road next year and headline. And it was such a big compliment to me. What people do, you know, if you go to most concerts, there's a warm-up act is playing and everybody's out having a beer, getting a t-shirt, taking a leak, walking down slowly, hanging out with their buddies. So the place is kind of half empty.
Right.
When we went out with Journey a few years ago, the crowds were in their seats right at 7 o'clock. And the promoter came up to us and says, we've never seen that either. You know, so there's all kinds of things we're kind of changing.
Yeah,
and I can testify to that. We went to that Journey show in Montreal with my wife, and she's always like, oh, we'll just show up at 8 o'clock and we'll go see whatever Bon Jovi forget. For that night, she was like, can we leave at like 5 so we can make sure that traffic and My wife doesn't do that for anybody.
It's funny.
For Loverboy, she did.
I forgot about that show, and you brought that up. I totally do remember doing the same thing.
Yep.
Yeah, me and Kat Spencer, we got free tickets from the radio station, and we walked over because it's a block over, and he's like, we need to be there for Loverboy.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
It was a triple bill.
Yeah. That's a big compliment. You know what? And that makes me happy. And that's another reason why I'm happy. So we're going to get up there. They're giving us an hour. We're
going to
play 9-10 songs. We're just going to kick some ass and then get in the tour bus and go to the next town. And
nice.
And we're going to try to do it with as much poise and Canadian spirit as we possibly can.
Yep.
Plus, we're going to kick their ass.
Yeah. And just don't wear a Leaf shirt on stage. That's all I'm asking. But you very do have good. One Canadian date in Toronto on August 16th.
Yep.
No dates in Quebec. So no Montreal, no Quebec City. Is that something that might change? Or do you come back alone? Or in fact, I think you're actually doing a date in August at the Strangers in the Night, I believe.
Well, they were supposed to be doing that gig. I don't know what's going on with that. Are you guys still on the bill?
Yeah, the date's changing. Well, you know what's happening is some of the people can't operate unless it's a full capacity type situation.
Right.
And some of the provinces are asking for 50% capacity.
Or less, yeah. Montreal.
And going to be distance, and you got to wear a mask, and you got to, wear a diaper.
Hazmat suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, hazmat suits and the antennas. And look, I don't know. It's just crazy times, but promoters, they can't really do anything. So, what we're trying to do is we're just trying to let this whole virus thing just dissipate and go away. All the shows we're doing with the REO and Styx and Loverboy are all outdoor events. So,
yeah.
I know that there's going to be shows added on because as soon as they see it sell out that fast, a lot of promoters jump in and say, well, we'd like a show too. Right. So I could see coming to Montreal or Quebec anywhere and playing some Canadian shows as long as they're outside and there's no capacity rulings.
Right.
Yeah.
We spoke about loving every minute of it. You worked with Mutt Lang on the song, but on the album you worked with Tom Allum, who of course was known at that time for working with Judas Priest. Was that a moment where you sort of said to yourself, we need to toughen up our sound. We need to be a little bit more metal. Because metal was sort of taking over at that time. Talk to me about the decision to work with Tom and what was he like? Because here's another great producer.
Well, first off, one of Tom Allum's magic moments was when we were cutting, I think it was Loving Every Minute of It, in the studio. And it was towards the end of the night. And towards the end of the night, he'd always have a little tumbler of scotch going. And he was a standing producer. He was always standing.
Oh, wow.
He was tumbling his scotch because it was late in the night. We were almost ready to sit back. And the band played Loving Every Minute of It perfectly. And he puts the talkback mic on and he goes, change nothing immediately. And that's got to be one of the coolest statements I think I've ever heard. Change nothing immediately. You mean he just loved it. We were trying to toughen the sound up. Paul especially wanted to get away from certain things. He wanted to make it a little more guitar oriented.
Right.
We were trying to find a guy. He was available. Our regular production crew weren't available, like I was saying earlier, because we were working in Studio B. Studio A had somebody in, like Aerosmith or something. I mean, that's how crazy it was. And so we had our whole team on the other side. So we kind of thought, well, this is kind of crazy. But that's what we did. And we did a great album, and we had a lot of fun.
When you record a song that's written by Mutt Lang and he's not producing it, does he get final cut at the end of the day and say, nah, I don't like the mix, redo it?
Nope. Never got any final cut, never demanded it. He was just a gentleman through and through. He sent it to us and just let us have at it. And I think he's probably pretty proud of what we did.
Wow. Have you ever spoken to him since the song came out and asked him?
I have not spoken to him. I'm looking forward, a lot of things in my life I'd like to still do. One of them is to meet Mutt Lang.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. Welcome to the club.
And then I'll start wrapping up on this, but Little Mountain Studio, there are famous pictures of, Jack Blades with Bryan Adams, with Mark LaFrance, and all these people doing these big backing vocals on these albums.
Yeah.
How involved were you in that? And is that something where you're just sort of hanging out and they say, hey, look, Mike's over there. Mike, come on and sing on Dr. Feelgood, or come and sing on Living on a Prayer like you did.
And is it really like a favor thing, or do you get like a session rate for it?
They were all favors. They did it for us. We did it for them. Here's what happens. You get, like, let's say 7 or 8 guys around a microphone. Mm-hmm. You go, whoa, living on a prayer, or something like that.
Right.
Now you record that 10 times. That's 80 voices, right? Because you got guys 10 times, and every time it's just a little bit different. So it gives it that big chunky feel like you're in a stadium.
Yeah.
And I used to do it for them, and they used to do it for me. And sometimes they'd call us down, and sometimes we'd just be hanging out. I remember I looked through the window one time through Studio A. They had an entrance window into their little entrance area. And the singer for The Cult decided to make that his vocal room. So I looked through the thing to see if it was okay to come in. And he's just singing away like crazy, you know. And
wow,
I think it was Bob Rock was producing The Cult. And that was some of their best music that came out of that studio. I guarantee you that.
Yeah, with Mickey Curry on drums.
Absolutely,
I mean, come on.
Absolutely, man.
So who's singing on your albums? Because we know Lou Gramm's on Bryan Adams' record, and we know Jack Blades and Bryan Adams are on Motley Crue's record. And so who's on your record? I mean, is Nikki Sixx or Vince Neil, or like, who, do you have any clue?
Is there any secrets?
I think we probably had I can't even remember. Probably had Mark LaFrance and all the guys in the band. And
Mark LaFrance, who's a drummer in Canada, is on all of these recordings because he was like he was the Mountain Studio rat guy, you know.
And these guys used to come in and do it for nothing, just because we're friends, and we do it for them. For us. I'm trying to think who was on our record. Now it goes back a way, so I'd have to really think it through.
Well, but in the early 80s, when Bryan Adams was doing Reckless and Cuts Like a Knife, he had Lou Gramm next door, and Lou Gramm came in. So I guess around the same time when you were doing Get Lucky and stuff, was Lou around doing stuff for you back?
I didn't see Lou, but we were pretty intense into staying in our room and finishing the project up. That's back when studio time was very, very expensive. It's kind of changed a bit now because everybody's recording everywhere. But back in those days, it was like $3,000 a day. So you really wanted to get your stuff done fast. You know, you could go through a lot of money very quickly.
Wow.
And then you learn what recoupment costs are and you go, what?
We need to sell 6 million records to pay for the catering? Oh, okay.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, listen, the big tour kicking off at the end of May. Grand Rapids, the first date. Basically, you're not going to get a better tour than this summer. It's just a tour of nothing but number one hits, man. Pretty much hitting every city across the U.S. We got the Toronto gig as well at the Budweiser stage. Make sure you go to Ticketmaster.ca to get your tickets for that. Thanks a lot, Mike. This was fantastic. Hopefully, we'll get to see you on the road this summer.
An all-new episode of the Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
Tuesday at noon.
Available wherever you stream.